Okay, thanks very much for coming. It's indeed an honour, particularly as I know so many people, either from old or online, and it's fucking great to be able to come and talk to you. Anyway, what we're going to do is, Pat and I have been sort of talking philosophically for quite a little while about what we think about standards and accessibility, either online or on the phone or when we meet up. And when Trovster said, do you want to come and harangue people, we thought what we'd do is we'd open out the conversation that we've been having and hope that you'll converse with us, because we're kind of moving to a way of thinking, but we haven't firmed it up, and we really want some more people's ideas. In order to be fully accessible, kind of orthodoxy says that your web pages should be sort of fully liquid, percent based or M based. All the text should be resizable. In fact, everything should really be text. You know, images are okay, but image replacement is considered to be something of a bit of a dirty secret or a dirty trick. You should, of course, use only a very limited palette, a palette that makes the web-safe colours look actually quite extensive in order to meet contrast requirements. And, of course, all of this is actually bollocks, because in the real world, you can't do that. We've had conversations on forums, etc., in which people have said, well, you know, if you can't do that, you should change the design. And that's all very well if you're just running a one-person blog or something, but actually, if you're running a corporate website where teams of highly paid marketing people come up with corporate palettes and typefaces, you can't go in and say, I'd like to change the design because, you know, a blind person or a person with visual impairment might find this difficult to read. It just wouldn't happen. It just wouldn't fly. And so what Pat and I have been discussing and coming up with ideas for is something that we're going to call, piggybacking off Jeremy Keith, unobtrusive accessibility. And the idea is that the compromises that you have to make should really be governed by the fact that you do the best you can within the business rules and within the parameters you're working. And you, I think we've all found in our jobs that you sometimes get accessibility and standards kind of under the radar. You're not telling the boss that you're doing them. You're kind of getting them in anyway, because you know they'll be good, and maybe actually the marketing people and the boss won't really care. And actually, if you're standing up in meetings and announcing that you propose to change the corporate logos and the typeface, etc., you just wouldn't be allowed to do it. I'm rambling.
That's all right.
Okay, cool. Please stop me and say, no, Bruce, you're wrong, or please give us an anecdote that confirms or gives another angle on what we're saying, because we'd sometimes we think we're maybe just two blokes having a chat and talking out of our bottoms. But
and it's not a polished kind of Doug Bowman style slick presentation that we're going to do tonight. It's, as Bruce says, it's mainly a little bit of a discussion. It's something for us to take away, hopefully, as well, as we kind of explore different themes, different ideas. And as Bruce mentioned, we don't have the answers either in many cases. You know, we're all kind of on the payroll of some company. We're trying to do the best we can, really. So that's the kind of format that we're hoping to kind of at least entertain you for about an hour. and after that, the bar is open anyway, so we can drown our sorrows with that.
So the compromises that I guess most of us make, or I've been making, for example, this week, is a site that I've been making is fixed width. And of course, orthodoxy is that you have a liquid page. I've been using a lot of image replacements. And I know that for people who have CSS on but images off, that's inaccessible. Personally, I think that's legit, because I think that's a choice that somebody's made. If they've chosen to configure their browser that way, that's up to them. I know that's a big disagreement in the accessibility world between universal design or universal access and accessibility for people with disabilities. But I agree with Joe Clark's definition that accessibility is about accommodating things that people can't easily change. But, you know, arguably, that's a compromise that I've made from my purist position. For example, I very rarely use the legend element in forms. I believe the spec actually says it's mandatory after a field set. And the legend element has massive accessibility benefits because all the big screen readers will read out the content of the legend before every prompt in the form. But the trouble is, it's just really, really ugly and terribly difficult to style. And a lot of the times, forms on websites are so disastrously off-putting for the punter that the marketing people quite rightly say, you're not going to pollute this already quite terrifying form with this ugly, unstyled element. So that's a compromise I've made, and I wonder if anybody else has made any dreadful compromises that they will share with us. Pat, have you?
I have.
Go on then.
Right, as I say, should I grab the mic and move it down here or whatever?
I'll go back up and bang on about you.
As you can see, it's very well rehearsed, this kind of handing over. As Bruce mentioned, I'm notorious, mainly for being a very, very idealistic kind of person. When you're on a mailing list or whatever, forums, etc., you will hear me or read me banging on about, you know, in an ideal world, this is how it should be. And, you know, going on about all the things that we know should be done right. As Bruce mentioned, sites should resize. If you're resizing your text size, yes, it will be great if the site kind of adapted to whatever situation the user kind of prefers. Whatever, if they want a certain color combination, they want a certain size, they're on a certain device, maybe, you know, they're on the go on a PDA, they want to access the same site. Yeah, it would be great if, you know, it worked. From an idealist point of view, I see that, and I will be the first one to, you know, pull something up about somebody up about it if they said anything different in an ideal world. You know, using images in where you could really be using text, you know, things like, oh, do your buttons really need to be actual images? Could you not code them so that it's real, actual text in the HTML and use various techniques? Could use, like, you know, the latest CSS with a bit of JavaScript to make up for older browsers that can't do it? Yeah, it would be great. Color contrast, again, as Bruce mentions, it would be great if I could design my sites completely with color combinations that, you know, always pass. If you run it through Jez Lemon's wonderful little tool, always come up and say, yeah, that's perfect, that gives you just enough contrast between your background and foreground.
Can you edit out the words Jez Lemon's wonderful little tool? Because I think he's
yes, leave bollocks in, but Jez Lemon is a bleep word.
His little tool.
Okay, Jez Lemon's huge, massive tool. So, you know, and generally catering to all users. No, we're all trying to do our best. In an ideal world, yes, I would create websites that work for everybody in any kind of situation. But, you know, the reality is the pragmatist in me, the realist, the one that actually needs to get a paycheck at the end of the month to pay for mortgage, realizes that this is not always possible. You know, there are many accessibility checkpoints and guidelines which are great in principle, and in the kind of very contrived kind of lab situation that sometimes I think the W3C work in when they devise their guidelines, it would be great. We could do all that. But there are many situations where these accessibility guidelines, as good as they are, and, you know, as right as they are, and you read them and you think, yes, you know, I see exactly what you mean and why this could be an issue if I don't do it. The reality is that they're sometimes at complete odds with, you know, things that other requirements, other business requirements that in the real world we have to face.
Well, for example, one of the things in WCAG says, I can't remember the exact wording, but it's provide a mechanism to skip over repeated page areas, which is basically skip links, isn't it? Now, skip links is a great idea, and there's a huge accessibility benefits for skip links, and I've gone on record of saying that your skip links should be visible. And the reason I've said that is because I've watched my next door neighbour, who's got arthritis, try to use the mouse and just not be able to do it. But because she's not visually impaired, if it was like a 1 pixel spacer GIF with alt of skip to main content, she wouldn't know it exists. But the trouble is with skip links is a lot of site owners, a lot of business people won't let the first link on the page which is generally, you know, going to be in the nice, attractive brand logo, B, plain text, skip to main content. And also, and this is, I know, is Pat's big bugbear, it should be the user agent that deals with that. The user agent should be able to sort that out. You know, and we're all, to a greater or lesser extent, committed to web standards, you know, and the separation of presentation and content is our mantra. And so bunging in things, actually, that are not content, that actually just help get over deficiencies in the user agent, arguably isn't part of our remit at all. And this is where we're interested in your help, either now or by email afterwards, is because I acknowledge that there's a big accessibility bonus in skip links, but the purist in me rebels about basically patching up the UA and the sheer ugliness of it. And as an aside, I think one of the things that was deprecated in HTML 4 or 4.01 was the menu element, which was a kind of list, like an unordered list, but it was a menu, and it was used for a menu, you know, the site navigation. And if we were still using the menu attribute, a menu element, it would be a piece of cake for the screen reader people to skip over, you know, go to the next bit of content that wasn't in the menu element. There you've got to skip links. But for some reason, I've no idea what the thinking was, and I'd love to get Tim Berners-Lee over a few pints and ask him why they deprecated what to me seems a highly useful and semantic element.
Is there not a navigation list item coming up?
There is an XHTML 2 or moments in the draft.
Yeah. But, I mean, so when it comes out in 2057.
And the browser's adopted in 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. That's another 10 years. And yeah, it'll be great.
You're what's stopping you doing it?
What's stopping us?
Matthew, what's stopping us doing XML?
No user agent would support it unless we developed a standard, and even then it would take, well, at least a few years before, even if we developed a grassroots standard, you know, people talk about microformats, you know, best practices, patterns, you know, John Alsop's kind of web patterns idea. It's all great if we all, you know, around the world could agree to some kind of baseline level of whenever we want a navigation, we will always have a class. Baseline, yeah.
Oh, no.
It's the new speak. You've got to learn it. Yes, so if we all agreed that, yeah, we all, you know, even though, as we're going to touch on later on, if even though we know that HTML itself is a very generic kind of language with a few caveats that we're going to cover, if we all agreed that, yes, we could do it 100 different ways to create the navigation, if we all said, but whatever we do as a navigation, we'll give it a certain class, and we'll all around the world agree that, yeah, whenever we give this particular class, we identify this as a navigation, then in a future where then the web browsers, the user agents will understand that, yes, we could have it right here, right now, so to speak, with the technology of now, once they implement it, we could say, look out for a class that is called navigation or nav element or whatever we want to call it, and do it. But as in the here and now, we can't, because as their browsers pretty much treat it as very generic kind of markup, which in theory it's supposed to be. So all the idea of, you know, microformats are great, you know, they do great t-shirts and everything else. And you know, it's a good idea, hello. It's a good idea to have, but it's all good and well that we as developers kind of work towards this code. And it's good to see, you know, groups like the WattWG kind of pushing it. It helps that WattWG, a lot of people, the WattWG work for Opera, and you can start imagining that Opera will start implementing a lot of these things. But the reality is that, you know, as much as we as developers feel really good about, oh, we're really kind of setting a new standard within the confines of HTML, we're working towards, you know, getting better semantics into HTML. Yes, you can then have like extensions for Firefox or bookmarklets or various other clever things that extract this semantic information. But for the user agent itself, for instance, for screen readers, it doesn't make any difference at all at this stage. It's great that we're all kind of, you know, congratulating ourselves that we're using HCard and we're using, you know, the various V-card kind of things or whatever other kind of microformats are out there. And, you know, the microformat kind of
way of deciding, you know, by actually approving it and getting it peer reviewed and everything else, is really good. But until we actually get, you know, screen reader manufacturers to acknowledge that development, where at this stage some assistive technology isn't even acknowledging, you know, web standards, basic kind of web standards, they're kind of still ignoring it on the grounds that, well, the majority of the web is still loads of tag soup, so why should we kind of work towards identifying proper semantically structured HTML when 90% of the stuff out there isn't? We'd rather invest time in getting heuristics out there in our products that kind of try to understand what is effectively tag soup, and we will ignore whatever you try to do based on the spec, because, you know, nobody else does it, so we'd rather spend time doing that. So I'm losing my thread, here. Until we can do it, we as developers can do it, we can feel great about using microformats and things like that. And we could invent a microformat to define parts of the layout of a page, or the functional layout of a page. We could clearly define the role, and that's another kind of key word for the XHTML2 kind of stuff. We could define the role of certain parts of the page. Now we could sit here and actually draft something tonight and say, right, as of tomorrow, all of us here will say, right, we will use a certain class, we'll call it Geek in the Park Navigation for the navigation, Geek in the Park content, and we will expect screen readers to look for that particular class, but it's not going to happen. So it's kind of a, yes, we can do it, but it won't make a difference at this point, unfortunately, I think.
It's also pertinent at the moment that Pat and I have been having phone conversations, because our newest bugbear is indeed the deficiencies of HTML and the deficiencies of the proposed XHTML2 spec. I've mentioned the fact that it's a shame that the menu element was deprecated. In HTML3, there was a figure element that was dropped and never made it to 3.2, and that would be brilliant, because that was allowing you to associate a caption with an image and actually sort of link them together. That never got into the spec because it was considered too difficult to implement at the time. That would be great to be in XHTML2, but instead they've still got all the crap that the computer scientists put in there in the early 90s. You've still got keyboard, var, samp, code, which has been used. There's now block code. You know, what the hell is block code?
And they've got arguably presentational elements like superscript and subscript, which are presentational, because even if you look at the examples they give, they show various things, or you might use them when you're marking up certain mathematical formulas or chemical formulas, or in French you might need the, you know, if you do mademoiselle, you need the capital M and then LLE, but that needs to be superscripted. So they're kind of mixing this element that in essence says you need to take the text, make it slightly bigger and put it up or down. And they're trying to... I engaged them in a conversation recently on the actual HTML W3C mailing list, where they discussed the future of HTML. And I pulled them up about it and I said, you know, why is this kind of stuff still in there? It is clearly presentational. And they're trying to justify it by spurious, well, it is actually useful because there is no other way of doing this at the moment. But, that's not an answer that really kind of pleased me. To a certain extent, baselines is a thorny subject, but baselines will be defined. We need Jez here.
We do need Jez here, because Jez knows good. Everything about WCAG 2.
Because baselines, yes, I, as a company, for instance, I could say, right, my baseline will be, it's technology-based and not browser-based. So I couldn't say, well, my site only works, my baseline says my site will only work if you're using Internet Explorer 7 and a certain plugin. That's not how it works. You need to be able to say my site works if you're using HTML, CSS, and you could say my baseline includes Flash. The interesting thing with that is that you will probably get some companies that will try to use the excuse of baselines to push for, well, everybody needs that and my special Bruce Patrick plugin that will stream content that is purely proprietary to us. But that will be, if it ever comes to finally a court case about, you know, the DDA, a website being accessible or not accessible, I would reckon that the attack would be mainly on did you choose a baseline that is just unrealistic for the real world. If I said, you know, my site only supports my browser that I've created that supports my particular markup that I've invented, I could do that as a baseline.
But you still would lose the court case.
Yeah, that would be contested. They would, the court case would, the focus of the court case would shift from, hopefully, from you're not passing a validation, because you could get around that by saying, well, there is no validator for the special Patrick Bruce ML. But, you know, it would, the attack would be, your baseline is unrealistic. Therefore, you need to develop a site that uses baselines that are representative of, you know, the standard of what people are using currently, which would, for my own part, for the University of Salford website, for those who don't know, I manage a large university website. We've talked a bit about baselines. The problem is I'm the only one that's really kind of in the know about accessibility, but I've talked with colleagues about baselines, and what's going to happen mainly with also with a lot of other university websites, they are going to be very conservative and say our baseline is HTML. Full stop. There's nothing more than that.
Right? The way I see it.
Go on.
We're in a boat, right? So there's the developer with one oar, mm-hmm. and there's the user with the other. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is, if all right, so the developer has got social responsibility and we have to move forward and become more educated in order to meet the needs of the user. But you know what? The user has to row a little bit as well, because you know we're just going to go around in circles. And I think that's one of the issues, that everybody sees the onus being on the developer all the time, and I want to see more of the onus put on the user.
I completely agree. And in the introduction to a really great quality new accessibility book available in a bookshop near you, that's the one. I very firmly say, and
I'll do the book pin.
The PAS, the PAS 78 says, it is up to the user. You know, if your user comes to you with JAWS 1 and IE 2 and says, I can't access your site, tough shit. Really, tough shit, you know, because
is that what it says in the actual.
I am paraphrasing it. I believe it's actually tough titty.
Oh right, that's very good.
No, but I completely agree with you. The user has to come too, and we touched a little bit on whether it's legitimate to expect us as developers to make up for deficiencies in the user agents or the browsers. But equally, the users really need to know how to use their browsers. Now, the browser manufacturers could make it simpler and perhaps got a cunning plan for that to happen. And again, you can help us, because I'm quite torn. You know, I think skip links is a user agent problem. But other things that are user agent problems, I'll work to patch up in the site. I don't know exactly where I stand.
I mean, it's a slippery slope. Once you start saying things like, well, we don't care because it's a user agent issue, I've come across recently discussions where people said, why do I need to put alt attributes on my images with text when OCR technology is coming in leaps and bounds, and shouldn't it be a user agent issue to actually look at the images and analyse them, work out what's happening there? You know, they were kind of sucked into the artificial intelligence thing a bit, I think, but you know.
Alt
tags. I believe actually in this splendid book. In the glossary, I think we say
that we're hoping that in WCAG 3 there will be a penalty of death for calling them.
It says it is evil and wrong to refer to this as an alt tag, as there is no alt element in XHTML, and many hope that WCAG 3 will mandate the death penalty for calling them this.
So we're a bit hardline. In certain respects. Yeah. But, I lost my completely where
you're
we were
talking
going
about user agents, patching up a user agent. And we're going to talk about why don't the UAs on first installation ask pertinent questions.
Yes.
You were.
As I said, we had a carefully constructed plan, but it's great that we're already throwing it in the wind. But, you know, as we said, you know, it's a conversation. That's the way we want to run it, really. We're not here to kind of expound on great truths that we've worked out hiding away in a monastery for, you know, 2 years studying the markup and studying the specs and working it out. I might actually jump into my flow and then get to that particular point when we get to it, really. Let's see, where was I?
Yeah, so I was talking about when I started off saying, you know, I am very idealistic and I can be very, very kind of hardline, as we were just proposing kind of death penalty. No, I can be, I'm very passionate about accessibility for some reason. I'm very, you know, and I can be very idealistic saying, you know, in an ideal world, this is how it should be. But at the end of the day, as I said, you know, we work in the real world, well, most of us do. And you know, some people that we know do work in a fantasy world, but as I said, a lot of times when you've got these ideas of I want to do the right thing, and that's the main thing. We want to do the right thing in terms of accessibility, in terms of making our sites work for, you know, the majority of users in any situation. But we come across we're complete opposites sometimes with things like, you know, the needs of branding, as Bruce already touched upon. You know, we might be bound by a corporate identity, which mandates a certain kind of corporate palette, corporate typeface, a certain logo that, you know, God forbid you change it into anything else, because we might lose our kind of complete brand recognition or anything like that. And also, you know, the marketing needs. I really need this particular product or course or initiative or whatever. We really want to make a big splash, so we need something that's really attention-grabbing. For visual users, that often means things like, you know, things need to be really brightly coloured, you know, things flying into the screen, things, I'm not going to say blinking, but, you know, grabbing people's attentions. There are certainly kind of, for visual users, there are certain tricks, certain things that sometimes you have to employ to actually achieve the kind of ideas that you have, the kind of business goals that you have. And also, there's the other side of, it would be great if we all had unlimited time and unlimited budget, so that we know that, you know, we're putting a video up, right, we'll do an alternative version, we'll do a captioned version, we'll do one version where the captions are, you know, burnt into the video, we'll do an alternative version with Smile, and we'll do one for Windows and everything else. Maybe we use a bit of Flash as well and try to make sure that that's accessible. But again, the reality is that, you know, if you're not working, well, if you are working in a company with a limited time and budget, I'd like to come for an interview. But in the reality, you know, it's often a case, as we're already saying, where we're often forced to do things stealthily and under the radar. We're doing accessibility because we care, not because we're told to care. But if you start coming along and say to your boss, right, it's great that we're going to put the latest kind of advertising campaign up there. Yes, it's only going to take me 5 minutes to upload the video, but could I have another 3 days to actually sit there and type up a transcript? And then I need to devise a way of making the various kind of alternative ways available. At the same time, I need to make all these links to the alternative version available, but I really don't want to impede in terms of, you know, being under the radar. It doesn't have to be too obvious so that people from the marketing department call you up and say, what is that link doing under my beautiful, beautifully designed kind of video and everything else? So there are these realities that, unfortunately, you know, as much as we'd like to just turn around and say, well, no, if it's not accessible, I'm not doing it. You know, some of us, I'm in the good situation where I've got a day job that pays. I can turn down offers of freelance jobs when I think, you know, this goes against what I believe in. I don't really want to do this website because, you know, for whatever reason, I don't think this should be done. But in the day job itself, you know, we haven't got the luxury of turning down jobs if we're being told to, you know, this is what you do. You've got one day to do this. It's not that easy to say, well, I refuse to do it unless we're actually working on, have we got a transcript? Have we got this? Have we got that? So I'm just going to quickly, as an example, talk a little bit about a redesign that I did recently. As I mentioned before, I work at the University of Salford. It's kind of a medium-sized university. And I've been there since 2001. It's been a long time now. We're famous in those circles for having one of the first university websites that kind of switched completely to tableless, XHTML, CSS, accessibility type stuff. You know, so, you know, doing all the right things. And we're trying to kind of obviously carry on with that because it's the right thing to do from a, you know, from a maintenance point of view and everything else. And again, Book Pimp, I've got a whole article in the book here talking a little bit about this redesign and the various challenges of it. Thank you, lovely assistant Bruce. So, as I say, I've got a certain commitment. I want to make sure that, you know, at the least, my name is out there. If people now go onto the new Salford website and it's a bag of shit, you know, I need to make sure that it's actually working all right. It's still accessible. So I've got this commitment to, I want to make something that's accessible. But with this latest redesign, which we carried out over the course of the last 6 months, we had a new branding that came in, new visual identity elements and everything else, and we needed to make a big splash about it. So I was kind of, this was a clear example of what we're talking about, where from my point of view, I really wanted to create a site that is perfectly accessible, you know, caters to all the audiences, does all the right things, colour contrast, etc., etc. But the reality was that because of the time schedule and because of the fact that mainly it's a team of one, which is moi, that's doing all this web stuff, it was just not possible to kind of go all the way with accessibility. So there were a few pragmatic, and that's kind of my favourite word, pragmatic decisions that had to be made. You have to weigh up, yes, what's right, what's morally right to do with, you know, time, resources, capabilities of other people involved in the project, etc. So I'm just going to touch upon, you know, a few of the accessibility sins, and I'll openly kind of talk about them. A few of the accessibility sins that I have kind of committed in the latest redesign of the website. And unfortunately, we haven't got a projection here, but, you know, if you, we'll send an email out later on, and if you have a look at the site, you'll see what I mean. I mean, it's not horrible. I mean, I don't want to create this image now that in people's minds that it's completely inaccessible, but there are certain things that I personally know that could have been done better in a certain situation, but just because of the reality of how it happened, didn't really. So, let me just have a quick look. Yeah, so I'll say the reality is that, you know, I myself, my position as web editor sits in marketing and communications. And so I get the full brunt of, you know, the whole story about the branding and you know, the impact on the target audience, you know, the where the kind of the masters of the corporate identity, we're the ones that actually go out to other people and say, that's not a corporate colour, you can't use that, and oh, the logo needs to be always in that position on that page. If you print it, it needs to be there, etc., etc. So obviously, I'm in the, probably the worst position to disagree with any of the mandates that come from up top, because, you know, I'm right at the source, really. And as I said, I'm a team of one, mainly, you know, doing the majority of coding and also the marketing side for a lot of things on the website. And with the recent redesign, as I said, there was a few changes in terms of our visual identity that needed to be carried out onto the website. So some of the accessibility kind of nightmares that I've had, and before I started the redesign, I actually consulted with a few of my accessibility buddies on various mailing lists and stuff, basically along the lines of, you know, don't excommunicate me, you know, don't throw me out of your treehouse club, but I'm fully aware that what I'm about to do is not, you know, in line with the hardline idealist kind of way of doing things, but that it's the reality of the job. And I will do my best to kind of work as much as I can under the radar to bring things back in terms of accessibility, but that, you know, there are certain real world requirements that demand that I do these particular things. So they've all been very nice. You know, you didn't kick me out. Yes.
Well, that's what we're
going to
do tonight.
Oh, is it the official? Yeah. Make it official. Make it nice.
Debag you and roll you in tar and feathers.
That's very nice. Yeah, cheers for that. So a few kind of the main ones that stand out. I had a thought, you know, obviously well prepared. Coming on the train, coming down here, I had a kind of a top four list of things that I know I've done. There's probably a few more here and there. Top four list of things that I've done in the recent redesign that are suboptimal. That's another one of my favourite words. Suboptimal. But from a pragmatic point of view, it had to be done. Yes, as Bruce mentioned himself, you know, I've also used fixed width. Our design is fixed width in pixels.
Isn't it? Fashionable.
And Karen's had enough, and that's it. Bye. Yes, it's a riveting subject. So, yeah, fixed width, 790-odd pixels or a little bit less, whatever the BBC is using. Ooh, yeah. Horrid. Also, the site makes a lot of use of basic images for buttons. And the images are mainly text with a nice little border around. It's got kind of a knocked out little 45-degree corner to make it all very, very kind of fashionable, if we were talking about 2-3 years ago. But, you know, corporate world is a bit slow when it comes to, you know, cool stuff. Also, you know, big image headers on the pages, you know, to say what the page is about. Basically, your title for the page, effectively. That uses a nice big image, and it's actually an image. It's an image in the markup. No image replacement going on or anything like that. So, ooh, disaster. Obviously, you know, can't be resized. And what if I change colors? You know, the color in the image won't change and everything else. So, you know, not ideal, but I implemented it. And yeah, talking of colors, my hands were bound in terms of this is the corporate palette. This is what you can use. And we, for this campaign, we want to mainly use these colors anyway. So an even more limited kind of scope in terms of what I can do with this particular redesign. So, and then the pièce de résistance is, because the branding is, you know, it's a completely new, we've got a new advertising agency in, they're all zany and creative young people, you know, you really want them, you know, want to make a big splash about this new branding that we've got. And it's all mainly based on this kind of, I don't particularly like it, but it's this particular montage kind of style, collage kind of thing. It's very kind of, a lot of people refer to it as our kind of Sergeant Pepper type cover images. And, you know, that's pretty much what it is. It's a lot of images kind of superimposed, juxtaposed, and every image has got a certain kind of correlation with zany courses we do, or, you know, achievements that the university has had, and did you know that we're the first university to do blah, you know. So it's all got some kind of purpose, but it's all kind of mashed up together. And that needed to be...
They're all links.
Yeah, they're all links. I'll get to that in a minute. Wow. Yeah, ooh, it's an image map even.
Oh,
shock horror. Proper one. We needed to make a big splash about that. So, you know, center stage on the homepage needs to have the new branding image and, you know, a nice little explanation that pulls it all together for people, that people can explore our kind of... The tagline is limitless possibilities, so, you know, oh, great. So you have to explore it with a mouse, the various things and what happens there, and, you know, the description comes up. But I'll get to that in a minute, really. So just looking a bit at these are the top four kind of things that I know, you know, people, you know, the accessibilistas in the nasty sense of the word will look at that and kind of shake their head and say, oh, he just didn't get it, did he? You know, it's like, he's very idealistic on his emails, but, you know, he just didn't get it. But as I said, there are pragmatic reasons why that had to be implemented. In terms of fixed width, that is one that is kind of closely related to the next one, which is the use of images. In terms of our design, it's on most sides, it's kind of a three-column kind of design. And the rightmost column, as I say, it would be nice if we had it visually, but, you know, open your minds. Imagine. I'm going to do it in the medium of dance now. I'm going to interpret the website. Now, on the right-hand column is these kind of buttons that we created, which are, you know, a fixed-size image on the right-hand side. Mostly with text, so yes, they could have been implemented in a different way, but we'll get to that in a minute. So that's a fixed kind of column. The rest of the design could potentially kind of expand and contract with the size, but, you know, we actually went down, when I say we, it's mostly the royal we, because as I say, it's mainly a team of me doing it. We tried variations on the theme of, you know, making it elastic. It's the kind of special thing where you say, yeah, I want it elastic, but not quite, because I've got something that is not elastic. That's when the problem starts. If I went completely percent or completely M, everything was in the same kind of style, it would be a piece of cake to do it. The problem arose because of this use of fixed-sized images and certain kind of browsers not being too happy with things. We've honestly tried about six or seven, it's my apology to the world, we've honestly tried six or seven variations of basically doing two things at the same time. I want it fluid, but not quite, because I want it only fluid up until it gets to a certain size. So max width, min width, all of those things were kind of thrown into the pot in a variation of themes. Always kind of ending up with situations where it works in 90% of the cases, but if they have that particular combination of text size set, or if they don't refresh the page or whatever, things start falling apart, and in a rather bad way, in a very visible, oh, there's something wrong with this page kind of way, things overlapping, you know, links not working anymore, things falling underneath the content. So we've tried a variation of things, and in the end, the easiest one, the most consistent one, ended up being, let's stick a fixed width in. As I say, I did kind of ponder that for, all over now, 2-3 days really, sitting there thinking, oh, there must be a different way. And I really started getting into very exotic uses of CSS, where you start saying, okay, I can make everything flexible and fluid and everything else. What if I add kind of a fictitious border that's a certain pixel width to the right hand side, and then add a negative margin to counteract it and everything else? It always kind of worked in most cases, but there were always situations that were, you know, not completely edge cases. There were reasonable cases, like IE with default text size set to fairly small. Things started falling apart, and really, as I said, the CSS in the last attempts started becoming really, really exotic in terms of, you know, you couldn't really understand anymore what was going on. Until, as I said, the pragmatic decision was, I can't spend any more than, you know, the next 2-3 days trying to work something out. We will have to go for fixed. And that's really what we implemented. Also, because, as I said, we're using fixed width headers, the conundrum would have been, yes, if I make it all nice and fluid, minus the right-hand bar, if I managed even to solve that problem, the next problem would have arisen, which would be, if I've got this kind of big, large image that needs to span the whole top of the content, how do I implement that? Now, of course, you know, we're all kind of CSS kind of aces, you know, we're completely kind of, you know, we're at the cutting edge of things, and we know the latest kind of bit of JavaScript to counteract that and do certain things in certain browsers that don't do it, etc., etc. That's all well and good, you know, and I actually had devised a way, you know, reasonably simple. You start thinking about it, it's like, okay, I'll do something like a div. There's no overflow, and I'll have an oversized kind of image sitting in the background, or set it as a background image. Great, you know, it depends, you know, how much space there is. It will always stretch to 100% unless you go completely over your oversized image. Yeah, great stuff. We know how to do that. Problem with that is that, unfortunately, even though I'm a team of one centrally, what happens once you go down outside of our core site and into the school websites, into the faculty websites, research institutes, etc., you end up finding a vast array of web authors with, you know, skill levels ranging from you're not doing anything on Friday, you know how to use Word, here's a copy of Dreamweaver, you're doing our site, to, you know, people that, yes, are complete tech heads, and they know, you know, they'll actually argue with me about, you know, if you use this CSS, it will work better. You know, great stuff. But you have a huge range of people, and I couldn't, for the lower end of that particular spectrum, I couldn't say, yes, you know, all your pages need this header. And to do that, you know what you need to do? You need to go into Photoshop or whatever. Oh, I haven't got that. Oh, well, Paint Shop or whatever. Paint. And create these really oversized images, you know. And then the way it works is that your CSS will need to overflow it here and cut it off there. It's just not feasible. It's just not realistic to assume that people will have the same kind of knowledge. People that will maintain, in the end, will maintain these pages, will not have the same kind of technical ability that, you know, I have. It sounds really big-headed, and we'll probably need to open both doors later when I get out the pub to get my head through. But it's the reality. It's like, you know, we can know all the latest CSS tricks and wizardry of JavaScript to make even IE5 compliant with the latest standards. That's great stuff. But if the people that maintain these pages, and you don't have a content management system that takes care of all of that and only locks them into, you can only text edit here and there. If you've got people that actually need to use something like Dreamweaver to do it, the chances are extremely high that they're going to either mess it up completely or just not bother. They will not bother. They will take an image and, you know, because they will see the site on their screen and think, oh, well, okay, I just need to take an image, stick it in there.
Or the worst thing, of course, is that they're so worried about actually how to do it that they just don't update their bits of the site, and then you've got a dead website.
Yeah. They'll say, you know, every time I try to do something, the evil web editor comes down to my office and says, you know, you're not allowed to do that. He mumbles something about, you know, WCAG and things like that.
I worked at a site that I fell into the trap that Pat's talking about of using all the whizziest CSS, and none of the content authors could work out how to publish, so they're all sticking PDFs up.
Yeah.
And, you know,
because they don't have the time. They, you know, and a lot of them, and I understand them. The problem with Salford anyway is larger. Oh, is this podcast around the world? Yes, excellent. The problem with my employer, you see. Take my employer. Take him, please. No, it's basically that, you know, we've been crying out for a CMS type solution, but we haven't got one for a variety of political and financial reasons, whatever. So as I said, the situation is that people still using Dreamweaver to do things. Yes, if we had a CMS that takes care of all this stuff, you know, yes, it would be great. You know, it would be great to have a CMS that takes care of, you know, WCAG compliance, whatever that might mean to people. You know, takes care of the majority of the page, and they really only go in, change their text and everything else. But the reality is, now that's not happening at our place. So a lot of these kind of pragmatic decisions that I had to make were made mainly in the light of, I know how to do it, but I know that if I hand it over, they'll mess it up anyway. So I'd rather find, you know, not optimal, but slightly less evil than the alternative kind of way of doing things. And you have to weigh these things up. And as I said, you know, you might get the person who has only got 1 hour a week to do things. So you have to take that into consideration, unfortunately. And again, that's one of those real world kind of things that push you towards, you know, pragmatic solutions, really. So yeah, I've covered fixed width images. Colour contrast, as I said, there's not much more I can say really on that one. That's all right. It's very rude.
There's always one in.
Oh, you know, we'll wait for him now. What's his name? Yeah, colour contrast. As I said, there's not much I could have done in terms of, you know, no, I will now invent a new corporate colour and we will only use this. In fairness, I have been, you know, more and more involved now with the corporate identity review panels and everything else and making suggestions along the lines of, even though we got all the nice flashy, funky kind of neon bright colours, we really need a few more muted ones to complement them so that we can also use them for things like link text and everything else on a white background.
Or at least an alternate style sheet for those people for whom the contrast isn't good enough.
Yes, exactly.
They at least can use some style sheet widget on an accessibility page rather than nork about using, trying to work out how to get user style sheets into the browser, which is utterly impossible for anybody.
Exactly.
It's not impossible, but it's just too many contortions to go through.
Yeah, it's a propeller head kind of proposition.
I'm a great fan of alternate style sheets. However, nonsense! Their implementation in the browsers leaves something to be desired. And again, you could say, not my problem, it's a user agent problem. Sometimes I agree that it's not my problem, it's a UA problem, but I tend actually to think that alternate style sheets are my problem because I'm using them actually to get away from another problem, which is insufficient colour contrast.
Yeah.
Sorry, mate.
No, that's all right. No, I'm gathering my thoughts because, you know, that touches on kind of my hobby horse, my rant kind of topic to get me going. It's basically, you know, the proliferation of, as we touched on before, that we're trying, as we're content developers, we're often, you know, forced to counteract or make up for bad kind of functionality or missing functionality in user agents. Things like style sheet switches, you know, all the time you get people coming on forums and stuff, you know, how can I do the style sheet switching? Here's the list apart kind of thing where they do it in JavaScript. Here's the other one that does it in PHP and everything else. You know, you save it in a cookie so they come back later and they use the same style sheet. It's great. And, you know, along with things like, I also want to have a text resizer. So I've got, you know, text plus and minus buttons. That's really good. We need that on our site. Those are all the things that, you know, on an idealist point of view, yes, I would say, that is a user agent issue, and if the user agent is not implementing that in a sensible way, that is not our problem. We shouldn't get any shit as web content developers if, you know, browser developers are effectively lazy. You know, you hear a lot about, oh, have they read WCAG? You know, oh, let's tell them they're not complying to WCAG. I hardly ever hear anybody mention things like, you know, should we go and tell Microsoft that their browser isn't compliant to UAG, which is the User Agent Accessibility Guidelines. Also, maybe tellingly enough, WCAG and ATAG are, you know, they're working on version 2. UAG is still in version 1. Don't know if that's telling of, you know, the priority that even the W3C sees for that. But, as I said,
Pat and I have, because we're sad bastards with no life, we've been compiling a list of places where we think the browser
manufacturers or the user agent manufacturers could help us all out by making their software better. And so Pat and I have been getting a list together, which we hope to publish reasonably soon, either on webstandards.org, if we can get the full agreement of the rather fractious Accessibility Task Force, or if we can't get their agreement, we'll put it on our site. But it's yep. effectively a list for all the browser manufacturers of how they could comply with the spirit of the user agent accessibility guidelines.
Rather than just paying lip service to certain things by burying it deep into the preferences or anything else, but put things up right up front.
Yeah, well, what are the things? I mean, I can't remember all the things because, what was it? It was,
I mean, one of the UAG things says you should implement specifications when they can be useful to accessibility, which is almost like a wild card kind of statement. But there are things that have been in the HTML spec since forever, when dinosaurs roamed the earth. Things like, you know, link in the header, where you can link to, you know, previous, next. You can also define certain kind of other parts of your site, so link to home. Define the relationship that your current page has with other pages within the site, which is one of the kind of things I remember a really alcohol-driven kind of night with Andy Budd when he came up to Manchester about a year ago. It was just before the first deconstruct, so yeah, it must have been about a year ago, where we started talking about, you know, HTML as a language is great to mark up content. The problem is, to actually make a website, you have to start inside the bit that is for content, which will be body, you have to start putting in all the framework of your site. You need to start having a section for your navigation, a section for your header and everything else. Wouldn't it be great if we could ditch all that and basically say navigation, or your entire kind of, how is this page relating to other pages within the site? What other pages are there within the site? What functionality is there? If all that could actually be externalized completely, and if your HTML was only the current document, and your actual navigation was either a separate file altogether or a separate element in your page, so you could have, you know, body for the, instead of body, have content, and then the other one will be relationship of this page to other pages or something like that, or sitemap or something like that, an RDF reference to the sitemap, something along those lines. As I say, it's very vague, but what we're left with when we do complex sites, hello, is that we really spend majority of time putting the scaffolding in place and then having to inject the content in there. And again, the problem that we touched on before was, yes, we do all the scaffolding, but because there's no standard for it and there's no elements that are specific to that particular scaffolding stuff, then we start either inventing microformats that nobody supports, or, you know, we just do what we can. There's no kind of real standard. Hello.
It's all very interesting and it's great, but what I want to add to this is that we always seem to be talking about code and HTML, yeah? But my main issue is that if website is not usable, it doesn't matter how accessible it is. And if you can't find the website, if you can't locate it, then, you know, just because we build it, so many people will come.
Yeah.
So I want to know what you did in Salford to make it usable as opposed to accessible, or did you attack it as a two-pronged thing, or did you do one thing and then the other?
I mean, the whole usable versus accessible, or are they the same, well, two sides of the same coin kind of thing. Did I use a buzzword there?
No, that's a philosophical argument too far, isn't it?
Yes. as I say, we're not going to talk much about that, but as I say, just my view on that is, I mean, the main problem that we're having when we start talking about accessibility is because of all these shortcomings and because of the way we're all bumbling to actually find a good solution for things, it shifts the focus. You know, if this was all, if we had kind of say a language that takes care of all of the problems that, you know, in terms of how do we mark up a navigation so screen readers can use it, if there was an actual element for it, that discussion would shift now. It would shift away from the technicalities of how do I do it, but more in terms of what, you know, in terms of the content, and then starting to build more on that in terms of how to make it actually usable. The problem we face most of the time is that it is seen by a lot of people as a separate thing. And once you start talking about all the issues, the accessibility technical implementation is the one that usually takes up a lot of the time because there are so many grey areas. Hopefully, we'll be able to shift that conversation more towards the usable. But usability itself is part of accessibility to a certain extent.
They kind of go hand in hand. They overlap, overlapping Venn diagram circle type things.
People need to be able to find any of this. We talk about vision impairment, right? Who is the biggest blind user on the web?
Mr. Google.
Your mother.
No, I don't know. Have you seen her? Anyway. Yeah.
Well, look, have you heard the stats that the guy from, you know, Legal & General, the firm, at the launch of PAS 78, they gave us the stats. So have you heard the stats they gave about... I've got
they're in
here.
The book.
Basically, try
a surprise.
What was it? The Legal & General with Mike Davis, who you might know as Isa Farrow on the Accessify Forum. They made their site accessible because they were worried about the legal risk. And they found as side effects, 30% increase in natural search engine traffic, a significant improvement in Google rankings for all their target keywords, a 75% reduction in time for pages to load, accessible to mobile devices, their time to manage content reduced from an average of 5 days to half a day per job. They saved £200,000 a year on site maintenance. They got a 95% increase in visitors getting a life insurance quote, which was the purpose of that site, a 90% increase in sales online, and a 100% return on investment in 12 months. And that was the side effects of making the site accessible.
Would that make a difference? Would Google penalise you, as we're talking about search engines?
He's talking about mobile users. I mean,
that's an interesting one, because that touches on what I was saying before about... touches on the thing about... user agent responsibility. Where does that start? Where does that end? How can we cater for sites that do, you know, the right thing for all user agents or all users? There are things, you know, where you could specify style sheets specifically for mobile users, for handheld users. It's a shame that the majority of mobile browsers ignore that, still based on, as we said, the assumption that, well, the majority of web doesn't follow that, so why should we follow it? It's the usual chicken and egg problem. Until you start, so, you know, a lot of content out there uses, say, the handheld media kind of specification, we won't waste time implementing it in our user agent. And vice versa, you know, why should we as paid developers create really sophisticated handheld media style sheets if the device doesn't support them? So it's kind of, we're both waiting on both sides. Yellow.
I'm not a believer in anything Microsoft does, but the mobile browser now does have the option to put everything in resizes everything to
And that's a user agent, so that's a user functionality.
Agent attacking the problem.
And to a certain extent,
Is a good way to go.
I mean, it was their choice. Like, they didn't implement the handheld, but they implemented functionality that would then override any things that wouldn't work in that particular medium. I mean, in an ideal world, it would go hand in hand. If you don't find a handheld style sheet, do it yourself or offer the user the option of resizing it or linearizing it. If you do find a handheld media style sheet, for heaven's sake, use that, because it obviously shows that the developer actually cared. Whether they then got it right or wrong, I mean, that's then academic. Whether they, you know, set both the screen and the handheld and print and whatever all to point to the same style sheet that says this site is only 800 pixels wide, you know, that's then a problem. That's then squarely a problem on the developer's side. But as I said, we're trying to, it's kind of a bit of a lopsided ballet. We're all trying to kind of, you know, we should all be working together. Browser developers should say, right, great, you know, I'll honour your handheld style sheet. And developers should say, great, because you do that, I can now start using it. But we're kind of, it's all, you know.
Do you think that by developers offering all these extras like alternate style sheets and text resizing, that's a discouragement to user agent manufacturers to bother?
That is my point, is we've been carrying the fallacies and the shortcomings of user agents. Because at the end of the day, we're pragmatic, which is kind of, it ties it back into my thing. We're pragmatic and we know that, you know, I can't sit there and say, well, not my problem, it should be a user agent. When the manager says to me, you know, why is your site not working for our vice chancellor who's trying to look at it on his PDA? I can't go into a tirade about, oh, Microsoft, and, you know, make sure I spell it with a dollar sign in my email back and say, Microsoft, you know, the browser wars, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, great, fix it. Or you're out of a job. So in a pragmatic way, we had to do it. But yes, in an idealist way, we carry on doing that. And the browser developers think, oh, well, you know, it's not our problem. Not invented here kind of thing. And users, that's the problem. The users who, you know, we always assume, and, you know, for the majority of times, it can actually be true. We always assume the users to be extremely dense in terms of, you know, they, you know, oh, users don't know that they can resize their text. Well, yeah, we're not, in a certain extent, you know, to a certain extent, we're not prompting them to learn it, because we're then compensating for that by having big buttons that say, you know, text plus, text minus. And it actually reflects badly on sites that do the right thing but don't implement those widgets, because then they'll say, you know, look at that website, that's really shoddy, you know, it's it doesn't offer me the possibility to resize the text, where really what they should be doing is, it shouldn't be sites that educate the users. That's another one of my bugbears, because a lot of the current thinking is, okay, well, great, don't offer the text resizers. And I'm sorry if I'm kind of rambling a bit left, right, and centre, but it's a huge subject. But, you know, where currently they say in your accessibility statement, wouldn't it be great if you told people, oh, did you know that you can resize your text? And here's a little handy guide. If you're using Internet Explorer, do this. If you're using Firefox, do that. Here's a link to the BBC My Web, My Way website. It's great. It tells you even more about how to do things. Is it the responsibility of every single website out there to teach users how to use their site? I mean, I start thinking along the lines of, I don't know, if I was a petrol station selling gas, should I have, with every time I sell gas, should I hand out a little pamphlet saying, this is how you drive your car? You know, oh, this is the steering wheel, this is the gas, you know. Where does the, again, we were talking about before, the user agents need to be, you know, referencing the past 78, where they say we're all doing this according to WCAG, to the best of our intent. The browsers need to kind of join us halfway in terms of the browsers need to actually implement UAG and implement web standards. The users need to a certain extent, start to learn as well how they can actually use their particular product to access the web. And if the product isn't obvious enough, if there isn't, and that's my main bugbear, if it's not obvious, say that I can resize text in Internet Explorer, that's because they've hidden it deep down in the bowels of the preferences. And yes, oh, there is a toolbar button to do text resizing, but it's not there by default. But if you went into the personalize my toolbars, etc., etc., I can make it appear. Why not make it appear right away? First time you run it, have it there by default. You know, right there. I mean, I wrote a little crappy Firefox extension, which is probably, I still get about one or two emails a month on that one from people saying, oh, this is great, now I can resize text. It's basically just the, you know, plus minus and normalize it. I'm basically just calling the functions that are built into the browser and in the menu, but I've made it visible. You install the plugin, you've got three big buttons right in the toolbar. Great. And as I said, from the emails I get, there's loads of people that installed that and then thought that I'd done the great job of, you know, enabling this magnificent functionality, where it's like, well, it's built in there, mate. You know, it's like control, scroll wheel, whatever. But users don't get it. Why not have it then that on first install, either it shows it by default, something like, you know, here's the resize thing right there, you know, in front of your eyes. If you're then an experienced user, you're more likely to say, I don't need that. Customize toolbars, remove it, rather than expect people to say, right, okay, well, I need that. I'll go into study the preferences and make it visible. Or, you know, things like a wizard. Ooh, the wizard. Gandalf. Have it, when you first run it, it comes up. It already says, Firefox already says, I think the last time I installed it, rather than upgrade, it says, do you want to install all your, do you want to transfer all your favorites from IE? What about the next screen says, do you think you require, you know, the easy facility to resize text or whatever the word, I mean, I'm not going to go onto the wording, but, you know, So something like, do you need text resizing? Yes, no. Do you need a particular color combination? Otherwise, you can't, you know, you can't use the web. Do you want to use, if the developer has shown accessible kind of alternative style sheets, and then we can discuss about how we say that this is the alternative that is the accessible alternative, or, you know, the linearized alternative. Do you want that to be loaded by default rather than the, you know, unmarked one? All of that stuff, you know, the user agents, as we mentioned before, they pay lip service to UAG. They follow to the letter often, you know, things like if it says there needs to be a functionality that allows users to change the text, that doesn't, in UAG, that doesn't say how prominent does it need to be. If they bury it under five levels of preferences, somebody that questions it, they can say, oh, well, we've done it. No, it's there. It doesn't say where it needs to be. But, you know, if they follow the spirit of it, the idea... Just to say, I'm on a rant. I'll be there in a second. Neon signs, I know. But yeah, if they actually follow the spirit, which didn't say just, you know, just follow this as a legal requirement, but make it, you know, all of that stuff only says, you know, this will make it easier for your customers, your people that downloaded this browser, installed this browser. They will find it easier to use web content if you implement this. So why only implement it or on a kind of, well, we follow the letter, implement the spirit of it. Sorry.
Andy. There you go.
I was going to say that sort of runs parallel with what you were saying there, but when it comes down to the developer ourselves, I mean, we've got a lot of power in terms of what we can actually do to influence an agent. I mean, the fact that, I'd say, I don't know what the take-up is, but I use the web developer tool a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, why isn't there something already? I mean, I know you said you've got the text resize, but really there's a lot of stuff that can be addressed just using stuff like a little bit of JavaScript. I mean, even the things like navigation. I mean, I would say probably the majority of people, this is just a guess, it's not going to back it up, but most people who are using semantic markup will be marking up their navigation as navigation or nav hub, or, you know, there will be some defined elements, and there must be, I don't know, about their narrative, you know, put stuff together. Nice to be able to show people this is what we're talking about. This is what we'd like to see from user agent. It can be done already.
Yeah. I mean, what I always see is that just reminded me of another rant, but it's only a mini rant. Don't worry. One of the things that I see a lot, you know, very talented people like, you know, was it Steve Faulkner or Falcon? Hello, Steve. Was it
Faulkner?
Faulkner.
From NILS.
What's he? Yeah. Faulkner. Yeah. He's moving now to London to work for the Paciello Group. But he's done the, you know, the IE accessibility toolbar, and, you know, that's great. Firefox, you know, web dev toolbar, you can't get away from it. It's all great, but all I seem to see are these toolbars and plugins and various other things that are targeting the developers. This is what you need to actually check that you're doing the right thing with your page. What I'd really like to see is that talent also being put to good use, the same kind of good use, to implement kind of these widgets and things in the browser that are for users. Yeah, are for users. I mean, like my little simplistic text resize thing, that is meant specifically for users. And I'd love to see somebody actually take up the mantle. Forget about list me all the meta elements and, you know, the various kind of, oh, disable this, disable that. When it's something that's really kind of developer geeky kind of thing, think about, you know, the top 5-6 things that from a user perspective will be useful. You know, even, well, disabled style sheets could be useful from a user point of view, because if somebody has created a style sheet that is completely unusable for me, I might have a certain color deficiency or whatever, for whatever reason it doesn't linearize properly and I really need it linearized, having you know, plain vanilla kind of browser, I can't very easily, unless I kind of dig into the preferences again, say, ignore the entire style sheet. I looked at it the other day from an IE point of view. There are options to say, ignore the colors that the author has specified, ignore this, ignore that. Very much text-based. But there's nothing that says, ignore, you know, for instance, ignore positioning, ignore floating or whatever, something that makes it linearized. And all that functionality there is mainly meant for developers to do their accessibility testing or whatever that says linearize this page. That would be great if you just had a very functional four or five button toolbar that's very obvious and basically says this page is crap, I want it in a linear format, The colours aren't working right. I want, you know, expunge all kind of style sheet things. The JavaScript is behaving funky with my screen reader. Disable it. And, you know, just have it right there, you know, in your face. But for users, not for us developers. Because, you know, we already know what's wrong with it anyway. That helps us kind of streamline our testing or whatever. But, you know, nobody's thinking... Somebody think of the users, you know, that kind of thing.
That's right. And for the users, really means in the browser Chrome. Because...
Yeah, because otherwise you'll say, who's going to install that? Although, at that stage, you can start widening the discourse. And as I will kind of pull it back together.
Widen the discourse. Yes, you know, you can tell I've been working at university in marketing for too long. You can widen the discourse by looking at the stakeholders. What was I saying? I don't know. Loads of crap. You can start arguing that, you know, support kind of agencies or, you know, companies like the RNIB, RNID, organizations, not companies, like RNIB, RNID, maybe are the right ones to then kind of create guides for their customers that say, you know, if you are blind or, you know, heavily visually impaired or whatever, or if you are, you know, you've got a certain kind of color deficiency or whatever, this is what you really want. You want IE and you want to install this, 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 and this. For these reasons, this will make your life a lot easier. Rather than creating guides saying, you know, oh, this is how you can work around problems in your browser, actually have them having more of an active role in user education saying, you know, hey, you know, yes, you need a screen reader. These are the screen readers available. This is what you can do if you need your text bigger. This is what you can do, you know, you could install this. So it kind of, again, starts to work in kind of, there's a lot of people that need to solve this problem. And my main, as I say, to bring it kind of back to my main point is, there's a lot of pressure that usually is just applied to web developers who really are the ones at the, you know, at the coalface. We're the ones that, you know, for a majority of cases anyway, a lot of us, we know what's the right thing to do. But we're trying to compensate for so many other things that are missing. Users that are too thick to know that they can resize text because they've never been told. And, you know, it's never been exposed to them by the browsers. Browser developers need to make their tools more obvious, more fit for purpose for their particular audience. As I said, RNIB, RNID, all of that should really work with their particular, you know, I'll call them customers, with, you know, the people that they're trying to help.
Stakeholders,
thank you very much. Class there. So work with their stakeholders to help them and help in the education that they you know, needs to actually, you know, set up their browsing environment in a way that's beneficial to them. Because, you know, there are certain things that we know can be done and, you know, problems will not appear, or at least it will mitigate problems that you might encounter in the wild, wide web.
There's this really great little story. Have anyone heard of Kurt Vonnegut, the science fiction author? He's got this short story called The Handicapped General, and it's about this society where everybody has to be the same. So if you're really clever, you get this bubble in your head and you get thoughts. And if you're very beautiful, you have to wear a sack over your head. And if you're very thin, you're a ballet dancer. In order to be as bad as a fat ballet dancer, you have to carry your weights around the world.
You've been to my workplace, haven't
you? Well, it just seems that's the kind of society we want to try and avoid. We don't want to encourage that kind of behaviour.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's me being
the meeting. Very good. What was I saying? Da, 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 da. Yeah, so as I said, there are a lot of issues here. There are a lot of players involved here, a lot of stakeholders that really we all need to start. Oh, it's getting very tree huggy kind of thing, but we all need to start working together, take care of yourselves and each other kind of thing, you know, to make this work. But the pressure is really mainly on what you see a lot anyway, it's on developers. Oh, you're not developing to WCAG, you're breaking this particular guideline. Sorry, that was a mega tangent, this one. I'm just checking if there's anything...
Well, I can do the round-up, and then break, and then questions.
Oh, yeah, just one more point. Little point. As I said, I've covered... if you remember, way back about probably half an hour ago, I talked about the top four bad things that I did, you know, me bad, on the Salford website. And I think I've covered the first three. The fourth one was this interactive branding thing. And it's just a little one that kind of ties into an interesting point that I hope I've got. So this interactive, as I say, it would be great to show it, this interactive kind of exploration of our branding, which, just to say from a... Hang on, I'm going to stub this out. which in our print campaign, in our poster campaign, is really a massive poster with the actual full-on montage, colours and everything else, you know, these photographs cut up, mashed up. Underneath it, there's a little key line with numbers, and then there's a Diet Coke for my lean figure. There's a key line, you know, all the things have got numbers, and then there's, for every numbered point, there's like the explanation of, we chose this image because, well, in sexy terms, but, you know, this represents the courses in avionics that we do, and this shows that, you know, we work with the community or whatever. And as I said, I needed to do some kind of sexy kind of interactive or multimedia kind of way of presenting that for our new branding on our main site. So as I said, what I did, you know, I looked at various options, and what I ended up doing, if you visit the Salford website, is you'll see it's a big image, and it's marked up as an image map where all, wherever there's numbers, you know, that actually uses a bit of JavaScript that I crafted, it pops up the explanation right next to where the number is. It works both with mouse and with keyboard. It uses JavaScript, so I also implemented a non-JavaScript version, and I had a very discreet but still fairly visible link that comes before it that says, this uses JavaScript, you might, you know, if you're having problems, you might want to switch to the non-JavaScript and vice versa. So you can flip backwards and forwards between them. And I've really kind of spent a bit of time. That probably took me the longest. Well, it was the longest single section that I spent on the development, because I knew that I really wanted to do the right thing in a lot of cases. So I did not want to have something that, if we gave it out to tender to a design company, they would have come back with a nice bit of flash, and it would have been completely inaccessible. So I said, you know, look, before we do that, let me try and do something that still has the kind of visual effect that the marketing people were after. And they, you know, most of them would try it with a mouse, and, you know, it all works with a mouse great. I did my testing with a keyboard. It worked reasonably well there as well. JavaScript, non-JavaScript, as I said, that works. But, you know, when I started thinking about it, I thought, well, yeah, that's great, but what if I've, you know, cognitive disabilities, that could create a problem because, you know, text comes up and disappears. Also, if I'm using something like a screen magnifier, because of the way that the whole thing is built, it might be that, yes, I can use my keyboard or the mouse to, you know, highlight the certain numbers. The text appears, but the text, because of the way it's laid out, it's kind of a nice sexy box, but it might move off the viewport that I've now got because I'm, you know, zoomed right into the page. And if I, you know, depending on how I try to move my focus away to see the rest of the text, the whole thing might be disabled again, and the JavaScript would kind of disable that kind of textual presentation again. So it might create loads of problems, or be at least reasonably difficult for certain types of users to use. And, you know, I tried working around a variety of options, but in the end, again, the pragmatic thing was that I willingly said, okay, it works for, and that's a point that Bruce was kind of keen to make, I think, in the book as well, is that as much as we want to create content that works for everybody in every single situation, you have to be pragmatic as well and say, yes, you know, we don't want to exclude anybody, but if you really are tied to a certain deadline, a certain amount of time, a certain kind of set of resources, is it that wrong to, yes, you know, try your best, but if it works, you know, if you initially work towards 99% of your audience, yes, it's evil to say you're only 1% and we're not going to cater for you. And in an ideal world, you create a solution that works for everybody. But, you know, when push comes to shove and there is no one way of satisfying every single type of user, is it evil to say 99% of our visitors are sighted? Of that, about 80% use a mouse. The other ones are sighted but use a keyboard. And then, yes, there will be users with cognitive disabilities, and yes, there will be users with Zoom text, but we can't accommodate them in the current kind of format. And if they have a problem, yes, we have very clearly marked up kind of, you know, help files in terms of, you know, if you've got a problem with any of our content, please contact us and we'll do our utmost to kind of help you. But, you know, yes, there is the anticipation kind of aspect of, you know, trying to make your site as accessible as possible. But, you know, is it that bad if you're really pushed and you just concentrate on the reality of, you know, 99% of our users are sighted? And yes, I will try to do my utmost to make it work for screen readers. But if it comes to a certain situation, you know, I might have to willingly and knowingly say, yes, I know for a fact this won't work for this particular group. Is the risk worth taking? So it's about the pragmatism. Again, it's, you know, in a discussion, if I put that online now in a mailing list or on forum, you know, you'd get the, you know, well, that's nonsense. You know, of course you can. You know, what is it? You know, Macromedia have created this where you can do the flash and make it accessible, and you need to do like the fallback content in the object and this and that. And as I said, these are all great. If you've got the budget, if you've got the time. Obviously, you know, if you have that, there's no reason to, from the outset, say, well, you know, we're just not going to bother with them. But as I said, in the real world, in the reality, that's sometimes what you have to do.
Do you think that it's worthwhile, where you have to make compromises, talking about compromises in an accessibility statement, explaining?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, be open about, you know, your decisions and, you know, If you can, if you say, you know, all our site is working, you know, we built it to the best of our abilities, we're striving as much as we can to make it accessible to everybody. We are aware that certain sections will not work. If you want to list them, if it's only a handful, you can say, you know, yes, we are aware that that particular thing is not accessible. Please let us know if you have a problem and we can provide you with a content in an alternative format. And then, you know, If a call comes in for that, you know, be prepared to actually put the time in to do it. And then you actually got something that you can take to, you know, going back to our, well, the people that pay us. If you've got the evidence that you can say to your manager or whatever, you can say, look, we have had a request under law. We are obliged to at least acknowledge it and do something about it. Whether it now be, we'll prepare you a separate version and send it to you, or we'll spend some more time and actually develop it on the website so that we avoid having the same problem next time around. Yeah, as I said, but it makes it a lot easier also to sell. Again, it's all, you know, you can't say cut and dry, but it makes it easier then to sell to your manager. And so, rather than from the outset sit in the meeting where they say, oh, we need this, and when you move the mouse, it comes up, and somebody sits in the corner and says, well, that's not going to work for people that are using this particular browser with that cognitive disability and the text zoomed in at like 400% or whatever. It's about weighing up these various problems. I was just saying about the, you know, the reality is that, say, on the Salford site, 99% of people probably are, as I say, I don't have any hard figures, but say 90% are visual people that can see the site. And of that, the majority will be mouse-using visual users. And that, you know, yes, you can acknowledge it, but acknowledge that there will be problems, but sometimes you have to be pragmatic. And it's also, yeah, on that particular one with the, you know, the sexy all singing, all dancing kind of explanation of the key lines, the one thing that also kind of I had to weigh up was, what is the shelf life? And that's one of the things that I'm very keen on as well as a factor. What is the shelf life of that particular resource or site that you're doing? I knew that this particular case, just this section with the explore limitless possibilities thing, would have a shelf life probably of about 6 months at the most, because then that's when our new kind of run of the branding will come in. It will be along the same lines, but it will be kind of moving further. What we needed to do with this one was, we need to really make a big splash, both for internal and external purposes, saying, hey, we got, you know, this cool new stuff happening. In 6 months' time, I'd be very surprised if that was the main focus of the homepage. It will probably quieten down more and come back to, you know, these are the great courses we offer, this is etc. etc. So it's about the, you know, it's all good and well sitting there and saying, yes, we need to do it. It goes in with the resourcing and the time issue. If it was something that I knew was a fundamental section of our site from now until eternity, that, you know, it's the next 6-7 years, all our business depends on this, then you've got a far stronger, you know, motivator or driver. Oh, a bit of marketing speak there. Bit of to actually say, you know, we need to really make sure that, yes, there might be only 1%, but we really want to make sure that we get it right. It starts getting thinner and thinner, the, you know, the response that you get from marketing. If you said, yes, it's only 1% and it's only going to be up for 6 months and it's an outside chance, but we need to address it. So again, it's about the, you know, in the real world rather than in the, you know, limitless time, limitless resource, kind of sterile vacuum packed lab that the W3C might create their things in. You have to weigh that up. That is just one of the many factors that you have to kind of that come into play when you decide how far you take it. And as I said, you decide it very knowingly sometimes, saying, I know for a fact that what I'm doing right now will exclude a certain group. If you're prepared to do that, if you've got a good reason for it, and you also know if anything, if a call comes in, how to remedy that, then that's great. I mean, again, as I say, it's dangerous now to take that as a snippet now from tonight and say, well, we went to Geek in the Park. Patrick says, you know, fuck them, you know. It's like, don't really care about them. Just as long as you're knowingly doing it, that's fine. It's like, yeah, fuck them, I know them. Fuck them, yeah. Yeah, exactly, you know. German people using the web, nah, fuck them. You know, and I'm German, so I can say that. As I say, it's about the pragmatism, really. If there's one thing to take away from this, it's about, yeah, these are all the things. In the real world, you have to make that kind of decision. And, you know, you have to go by triage and say, right, you know, these are all the things we'd like to do. These are all the other things that we need to do. Try to do the best you can. Well, that's at least what I'm trying to do in most cases. You know, I try to do the best I can. If, you know, I don't have to agree everything with my bosses or anything else, and that touches on, you know, we do a lot of things under the radar. We try to do a lot of things hidden away. We've got skip links, but they only come up, they're at the top, but it only comes up and becomes visible as a proper text link when you hover or when you set your focus on it. So, you know, when you move with a keyboard, arguably, you know, no, it should be there. You know, the hardliners will tell you it should be there at all times, you know, so that even somebody, you know, is that comes to the site for the first time, they might be put off right away if they don't see a skip link right there and think, oh, it's not worth the hassle. But, you know, I argue that if it's the first link in your tab order and it appears the way we've done it, and, you know, it appears where you'd expect the first bit of content to be, you know, top left. Yes, if you have your, oh yeah, it activates if you tab to it, but we actually still hidden it away somewhere at the bottom. Somebody who might be using, as I said, you know, zoomed in view or something with a magnifier, they might miss it. But, you know, it's basically, we've carefully placed it where it is, people would expect the focus to move anyway. You can start saying that, yes, you know, in an ideal world, we'd have it visible. And yeah, oh, why not make it a feature of your design? Yeah, great. If you've got people that are open to that, you know, I'd rather have a very visible skip link that is nicely integrated into the site and doesn't look like, oh yeah, and we've plastered this on at the end because we need to. But in all other situations, to make it stealthily under the radar, you know, sometimes there are solutions. They're not 100% optimal, but they will, if you're doing it with the knowledge of, you know, what you're trying to do and also who your end users are going to be and what their issues might be. If you do it that way, you can at least do something that is not 100% evil while still doing it under the radar. If you've got the time, I mean, a lot of us, I think you mentioned it before, you know, we beaver away sometimes, you know, or we badger away, I don't know, one of the two. We do it, you know, if it was a chargeable job, you know, I might just do it without telling them, just because of, you know, I'm committed to actually making it, you know, doing the right thing. But as I said, there is the tension where doing the right thing in the eyes of, you know, whoever pays your bills starts kind of conflicting with other requirements and other drivers you've got. As I said, corporate identity, logos need to be in a certain typeface, etc. So, as I said, there isn't really a conclusion to what I've told you. Yeah. Oh, beautiful. As I said, just for my part, as I said, don't throw stones at me. You know, if you go onto the Salford website and say, ah, yeah, he's all talk when he's out there on the mailing list and stuff. But, you know, look what he does. You know, it's a do as I say, not as I do kind of thing. But, you know, as I said, there are the realities that sometimes need to be taken into account. And yeah, and that will pretty much conclude my little bit, I think. You can sit down now. Oh,
yeah. The
length of your talk is interesting.
No, that was interesting.
Pop's closed now.
That we go to as web developers to make things accessible, whereas if you turn the clock, it's probably an obsession, I think. If you turn the clock back 5 or 6 years, I don't know, we didn't give a shit, did we? It was all, oh, I can do this cool thing. Do you think we've become more morally aware, or is it a case of box ticking for our clients?
To be honest, I don't have many clients that really give a shit until I tell them that list.
I have legal firms who insist on these kind of accessibility Nazis. certainly send you lists of things in the site.
Yeah, but they're box ticking. But I'm fine.
So I'm doing my lunch hour just to keep myself entertained. Hello.
Yeah.
Your site is shite, and this is why.
I have a go at the DTI.
Your site is shite.com. I'll do that.
But I find that the stuff about, you know, the legal and general stats impresses more people. But also, it does become obsessive, and I've found myself becoming obsessed. So is it an abbreviation? Is it an acronym? And getting overly obsessive. But the kind of the take home that we'd like you to get from this isn't Patrick saying fuck 'em.
Well, that's quite good. It's
good, yeah.
But
only quote Patrick and don't involve me in that, that quote. What we'd like you to take home is that a lot of the things we spend a lot of time doing, we shouldn't be doing. It should be the user agents. Now's a good time because all the browsers are back in development. We've got a list that we've been jamming together of things that we'd like the user agent manufacturers to think about. Off the top of my head, I can't remember all of them, but it's things like skip links. That should be a UA feature, not us.
Title appearing when
you're using the keyboard, the title should appear on focusable things. If there's a title, it shouldn't only be on hover. How the hell the browser manufacturers can justify some information only appearing when you hover? You know, that is completely ignoring the user agent accessibility guidelines. Yeah. Other things like, I believe Safari still doesn't pass the focus to a form, to the input when you click to the label. You know, that's such a good
known bug, and it's been filed years ago.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I know Jeremy Keith, God bless him, has some script that allows you to plug that with JavaScript, but we shouldn't have to. It should be them. And I suppose the last thing I want to say is that if we get too obsessed about perfect accessibility, and there never can be, we can do ourselves a disservice in the eyes of our clients, I think. And, I found myself banging onto clients. You can see them thinking, we're never, ever, ever going to think about accessibility ever again because this bloke's...
That goes back to the maintainability as well. If you're handing over the site, you know, yes, it's like, what was it, peeing yourself when you're in black trousers, you know, it gives you a warm feeling, but nobody notices. Kind of. It's great. You hand over the site and it's plus parfait. It's like absolutely beautiful markup. And then the next week they passed it on to their internal team, and because they found it too difficult, they just stuck a table right in the middle of it.
That's right. So, and nobody wins, and you can't even say, and you're embarrassed about that site because if you cite it on your CV, people think you put the table there, so yeah. Nobody wins. Exactly. So I think what we're trying to say is, Let's not talk about in ever more navel-gazing about accessibility. Let's actually go out there and do what we can under the radar as part of the job. And when we publish our list of wish lists for the user agent manufacturers, if we put it on the webstandards.org, you know, maybe comment and say, let's do it. You know, let's get a bit of momentum and we'll all benefit.
And there's lots of grassroots, as I said, aimed at developers, you know, web developers. We need to make web developers more aware of WCAG and everything else.
Yeah.
That still needs to happen, obviously. I'm not saying shift the blame, but the same kind of pressure, I'd love to see the same kind of pressure, especially from groups like RNIB, being applied to browser manufacturers, because until they get, you know, well, obviously they'll think in terms of money, but, you know, if it starts becoming a really bad PR kind of job all across the media, saying, you know, even RNIB or whatever suggests switching from this browser to that, and they're getting all their stakeholders to do that, Microsoft will probably start noticing. You know, and the same goes with everything else. And this is not a Microsoft job kind of thing. It's not Microsoft bashing. This is all browser kind of bashing. Dave Hyatt from Safari, you know, get him on board. You know, he does comment every now and again. He's kind of jumped in, I think, on the other rant we had, well, I had, on the XHTML2 stuff. So he's kind of, he's away. You know, this is a new generation, I would say, or at least the old generation that's now more visible in their corporations. People like Chris Wilson, you know, they do listen. Yes, Microsoft has changed.
People might
say, oh, they're now starting to be blogging and they're trying to make up for it. But yeah, okay, they're trying to make up for, you know, years of bad PR and, you know, bad decisions. But now is the time, because now they are, these are the people that are actually now
as opposed to, I'll be a bit controversial, as opposed to some of the members of the W3C. These are actually people that, you know, engage with the community rather than just sitting in a sterile lab and saying, this is, you know, the only kind of markup that people will ever need to mark up their documents. And then all of a sudden that hits reality. It's like, well, you know, why have you still got all this computer science crap in your thing, sample, var, keyboard? Wouldn't it be better if you had more semantic elements for things like, you know, footnotes? You know, I'd love to see a sensibly implemented element or set of elements to handle footnotes and then not have the developers like us worry about, well, should I have it as a link in a square bracket that I then style to make it look like the typographic convention of a footnote, and then that links down to the page, and then I need to provide another link that links me back to where I was. That is one of those things where I would think, you know, if we can, and now is the time for XHTML2 because they're still not out. And well, as I said, it will be a long lead time before it's used, but, you know, if we can't expunge things like, you know, the crappy kind of elements like sample and keyboard and var, and if we can't start lobbying now for, you know, can we not have elements in there that actually make more sense? Things like, you know, a footnote, like a matched pair of footnote kind of elements, you know, here's to go to the footnote, here's to get back or whatever. And then say, then we can say, quite rightly, well, this is a user agent issue. Not have things like, well, the user agent should magically work it out with heuristics that, oh yeah, they've styled it like this, it's got a square bracket, this is presumably a reference to a footnote, but actually have something that's, you know, inequivocally, you know, tied in the markup and says this is actually a footnote or whatever the non-print background related kind of generic name for that kind of thing would be, additional information or whatever, have, you know, different levels of information. Then we can say, if that's in the spec, then we can start saying to user agents, right, you know, our time of, you know, making up for that is done. Your user agent needs to start supporting that because it's part of the spec.
Yeah, and the onus of we're saying that user agents should be able to do things with this information, the onus is still upon us to mark it up as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much. If you've got any questions, why don't we all have a pint first and then reconvene?
The answers will be far more amusing.
Mine's Pedigree.
How? We're available for children's parties, especially my rantings about
bar mitzvahs, funerals, and satanic orgies.
Lovely.
Karen, you had a question.